Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, by Carol Quigley. Closing in on Germany, 1943-1945. The year 1943 represented the turning point in the European struggle, as the year 1942 had seen the turning point in the Pacific. In 1943, North Africa was freed from the Nazi grasp in May. Sicily was overrun in July and August. The southern part of Italy was occupied, and the German armies were pushed backward from Eastern Europe. As a consequence, the Mediterranean was open to Allied traffic, and Italy was forced to surrender in September 1943. These were the obvious events of this critical year, 1943, open to public view and hopeful in the implications for the future. But the role of this year as a turning point in the conflict with Germany was much greater than this. For, behind the scenes, the military successes of the year forced decisions on strategic plans and post-war projects whose implications are still being worked out today. And still, very much behind the scenes, these strategic and post-war plans revealed deep fissures and rivalries among the three Allied powers. Rivalries among the members of a coalition are always to be expected, and are usually, and necessarily, kept secret during the war itself. In the Second World War, they were most significant in the year 1943. In the years before 1943, these disputes were more concerned with strategic decisions than with post-war planning, while in the later years, when strategy had been set, post-war plans were the chief causes of disputes. The year 1943, however, had its full share of both, since the major strategic decisions were made in that year, and these decisions, in themselves, played a major role in determining the nature of the post-war world. In the years 1941-1943, the chief strategic questions were concerned with two problems. One, should the European war against Germany continue to receive priority over the Pacific war against Japan? And two, should Germany be attacked indirectly by aerial bombardment, blockade, and guerrilla forces? Or should Europe be invaded with large infantry forces, either from England directly across the Channel to Western Europe, or from the Mediterranean through Southern Europe? The answers given to these strategic questions, especially the last one, played a major role in establishing the post-war political settlement in Europe. In the earlier years, a certain direction was given to post-war planning by Roosevelt's proclamation of the Four Freedoms of January 1941, and the Anglo-American publication of the Atlantic Charter in August 1941. When the stunning news of Pearl Harbor reached London, on December 7, 1941, Foreign Minister Eden was just leaving for Moscow. It was decided that he should go anyway, but that Prime Minister Churchill should go simultaneously to Washington to do all he could to prevent popular anti-Japanese feeling in the United States from reversing the agreement that the military defeat of Germany must have priority over the defeat of Japan. In Washington, at what was called the Arcadian Conference, December 22, 1941, through January 14, 1942, the exuberant Prime Minister found no desire to change the agreed military priorities and was able to plan intensified military activity along the lines already established. At the same time, Roosevelt presented him with a draft for a public declaration of the United Nations. This document declared that the 26 signatory states were fighting to defend life, liberty, independence, and religious freedom, and to preserve human rights and justice in their own lands as well as in other lands, and that they are now engaged in a common struggle against savage and brutal forces seeking to subjugate the world. Each signer promised to employ its full resources and to make no separate armistice or peace in the struggle for victory over Hitlerism. Most of the secret discussions leading up to the publication of this declaration on January 1, 1942, were concerned with verbal or procedural issues. But some of these were symbolic of future problems. There was considerable discussion as to the order in which signatures should be affixed to the document, the decision to rank them in two groups, with the four great powers of the United States, the United Kingdom, the Soviet Union, and China, followed by 22 lesser states in alphabetical order, was an early indication of the similar division which still exists in the United Nations today. The inclusion of China, in spite of its obvious weakness, among the great powers, was a concession made to the United States by the other powers. The American leaders, from Roosevelt down, insisted that China was, or at least should be, a great power, although the only evidence they could find to support this argument was its larger population. The Americans seemed to hope that by encouragement and reiteration, or perhaps even by invocation, China could be made into a great power, able to dominate the Far East after the defeat of Japan. Other notable features of this United Nations declaration were, 1. The fact that de Gaullist France was excluded from the signers in order to not recognize it as a government. 2. The fact that the United States was ranked first among the great powers. And 3. The difficulty in wording the declaration so that Japan, with which the Soviet Union was not at war, should not specifically be included among the enemy and yet, at the same time, should not be excluded from the brutal forces which were condemned. In the meantime, in Moscow, Anthony Eden was being faced with Soviet demands for a specific delimitation of the post-war boundaries of Eastern Europe. In the north, the Bolshevik leaders wanted explicit British recognition that Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania were parts of the Soviet Union, and that the Soviet-Finnish frontier should be as it had existed after the Winter War of 1939 through 1940. In the center, the Soviets demanded a frontier with Poland along the so-called Curzon Line, which followed, it was true, the linguistic frontier, but was 150 miles west of the Polish-Soviet frontier of the 1921 through 1939 period. In the south, Stalin wanted Eden to agree to a Soviet-Romanian border, which would have allowed Russia to have Bessarabia and Bukovina. These demands sought recognition of the Soviet Union's western boundary as it existed between the Nazi-Soviet Pact of September 1939 and Hitler's attack in June 1941, except that the Curzon Line was, in some places, slightly to the east of the 1940 line. Although these Soviet demands were clearly in conflict with the high purposes of the Atlantic Charter, Churchill was not averse to accepting them on grounds of physical necessity. But American objections to any settlement of territorial questions while the war was still going on forced him to refuse Stalin's requests. In general, the British found themselves in a difficult position between the high and proclaimed principles of the Americans and the low and secret interests of the Russians. Because of American pressure, Eden avoided any territorial commitments and persuaded Stalin to accept a 20-year Treaty of Alliance with Britain. This Anglo-Soviet Treaty of May 26, 1942, had no territorial provisions and included a statement that the signers would act in accordance with the two principles of not seeking territorial aggrandizement for themselves and of non-interference in the internal affairs of other states. Although the Soviet Union accepted the terms of the British alliance, in 1942 their suspicions of the West were still high, and their relations with Britain became increasingly unfriendly, reaching a critical stage by 1943. In Moscow, there was fear that the West wished to protract the war in order to bleed both Germany and the Soviet Union to death. It was feared that this end would be obtained if American supplies to Russia, were placed at a level sufficiently high to keep Russia fighting, but insufficiently high to allow her to defeat Hitler. To avoid this, Moscow continued to insist, with unreasonable repetition, on the need to increase Lend-Lease supplies to it, and, above all, on the need to open a second front on the continent by an immediate Anglo-American invasion of Europe from England. Judging, perhaps, that American psychology would work along the same lines of power politics as their own, a mistake which the Japanese, with considerably greater reason, had made in the months before Pearl Harbor, the Russians could not conceive that the United States would grant sufficient aid to Russia to permit a speedy defeat to Hitler, since such a policy, almost inevitably, would leave the victorious Soviet armies supreme in Eastern and probably also in Central Europe. As a matter of fact, while some Americans unquestionably did think in terms of power politics, and may, in a few cases, have gone so far as to prefer a Hitler victory over Stalin to a Stalin victory over Hitler, such people were very remote from the centers of power in the American government. At those centers of power, there was complete conviction in the value of unrestricted aid to Russia, the speediest possible defeat of Germany, and a full cross-channel invasion of Europe as soon as possible. In fact, these aims were so firmly embraced by those Americans with whom the Russians had relationships, men like Harry Hopkins, General Marshall, or Roosevelt himself, that these men sometimes misled Russians by expressing their hopes rather than their expectations, with the consequence that Russian suspicions were roused again. At a later date, when these hopes were not fulfilled, immediately after the signing of the Anglo-Soviet alliance, Soviet Foreign Commissar Molotov came to Washington to urge the need for an immediate second front in Europe. Although such a project would have been unwise, if not impossible, in 1942, the White House communique of June 11, 1942, sought to satisfy the Russians and to frighten the Germans by saying that full understanding was reached with regard to the urgent tasks of creating a second front in Europe in 1942. In the early summer of 1942, Soviet messages to Washington and to London continued to insist on the need for an immediate second front in Western Europe in order to reduce the Nazi military pressure on the Soviet forces. Recognizing the impossibility of such a venture in 1942, the Anglo-Americans sought to relieve the pressure on Russia by landing at a place where the German defense would not be so strong. It was this desire which resulted in the decision of July 25, 1942, to invade North Africa in November. Having made the decision to substitute this project for any possible cross-channel attack in 1942, it was necessary to convey the news to the Soviet Union. Churchill undertook this delicate task on his first meeting with Stalin in Moscow in August 1942. The result was a most unpleasant explosion by Stalin. The Soviet leader charged that Molotov had obtained a definite promise for a second front in 1942. That failure to carry out this promise would jeopardize Soviet military plans, and that Churchill was opposed to such a venture from cowardice. The strategic disputes among the three Allied powers were sharp and based on very different outlooks, but in no case did cowardice play any role. The Soviet insistence on an immediate, all-out cross-channel attack to relieve Nazi pressure on Russia was perfectly understandable, although insistence on such an attack in 1942 was unrealistic. Equally understandable was Russia's fear that the Anglo-Americans might divert their power from Germany in order to avoid a Soviet-dominated post-war Europe, although this fear showed no realistic appreciation of the American outlook. On the other hand, the British reluctance to attempt the cross-channel attack was perfectly clear. Sir Alan Brooke, the chief of the Imperial General Staff, opposed all plans for such an assault, while others, like Churchill, wanted to postpone such an attack indefinitely or reduce it to no more than a series of small raids to establish permanent anti-German bridgeheads in Western Europe. The difficulties of such raids were shown on August 19, 1942, when a force of 5,000 men, mostly Canadians, landed at Dieppe and suffered 3,350 casualties in a few hours. The Americans, especially General Marshall, were convinced that Germany could be defeated only by a cross-channel attack, and advocated one on the largest possible scale at the earliest possible date. These differences of strategic opinion reflected basic differences of outlook. The American outlook was largely military. They were eager to defeat Germany and end the war as soon as possible, and had little time or energy for political problems or post-war planning. The British, on the other hand, were much more concerned with political issues and the way in which the post-war situation would be influenced by strategic and military actions earlier. The Soviet leaders, to some extent, represented a combination of the two other points of view, and could do so because there was no such divergence between their military and political, or between their wartime and post-war aims. The more deeply the Anglo-Americans could be involved in the struggle with Germany, the sooner Germany could be defeated, and such a defeat, especially if it arose from a cross-channel attack, would deliver all of Eastern Europe into the power of the Red Armies, which would find no rivals in that area. Churchill and other British leaders could not forget the terrible casualties Britain had suffered in the trench warfare of 1916. They felt that these casualties had injured Britain permanently by wiping out a whole generation of Britain's young people, especially among the better educated class, and they were determined not to repeat this error in 1944. These leaders wanted a Balkan or Aegean offensive, which, they believed, would, with fewer casualties, leave the English-speaking powers dominant in the Mediterranean and in the Near East, would make it possible to balance Soviet power in Eastern Europe, and would cut the Soviet Union off from the Balkans and some of Central Europe. The possibility of Britain obtaining American consent to such an Aegean offensive was so remote that little effort was made to get it by direct persuasion. On the contrary, efforts to move toward it, step by step, were persistent. These efforts sought to postpone, or to reduce the emphasis on, the cross-channel invasion, since this would, inevitably, have compelled the end of Britain's Mediterranean projects. But here, again, American insistence on the cross-channel invasion was so emphatic that the British could not challenge this directly, just as they could not advocate an Aegean invasion directly. Instead, while accepting the cross-channel invasion explicitly, the British offered, one after another, alternative projects which would postpone or distract from the cross-channel invasion. The North African invasion was the first of these distractions, followed by the Sicilian campaign, and then by the Italian invasion. These were accepted by the Americans, since they felt it was urgent to do something to meet the Soviet demands for Anglo-American action against Hitler. Some kind of Balkan intervention was the next British proposal, but there was no hope of obtaining American consent to such a project. It was formally rejected by the Combined Chiefs of Staff on September 9th, 1943. Churchill did not give up, but continued to push these peripheral schemes as best he could. He ordered General Wilson, British commander in the Near East, quote, to be bold, even rash, in attacking the Germans in the Aegean, and he also tried to persuade Eisenhower to shift forces from Italy to the Aegean, or to persuade Turkey to declare war on Germany. The only success Churchill had in these efforts was to persuade the Americans to engage in an amphibious assault on Italy at Anzio after the Americans had canceled plans for such an attack and had decided to choke off the Italian offensive in order to concentrate on the cross-channel attack. In the long run, Churchill had to accept the American strategic plans because America would provide most of the supplies and even a majority of the men for any direct attack on Europe. The American ability to compel British acquiescence in strategic decisions was a very real element in the conduct of the war. It arose from the great British need for American manpower and supplies, and it functioned through the mechanism of the Combined Chiefs of Staff. When Churchill came to the Arcadian Conference in Washington at the end of 1941, his chief aim was to retain the established priority of Germany first. He obtained this very easily on its own intrinsic merits, but at the same time, he had to accept something he did not want, a combined chiefs of staff organization to control strategy on a worldwide basis. This new committee developed more power than Churchill or anyone else expected, because it had control of the supply of weapons. This power was decisive. Since no military operation could be conducted without weapons or supplies, control over these gave the combined chiefs of staff control over all operations and thus over the strategic conduct of the war and over all local commanders. The combined chiefs of staff operated through weekly meetings within the framework of the general policy decisions made by Roosevelt and Churchill at their periodic conferences. In this way, Britain's dependence on the United States for its implements of war gave the United States control of British strategic decisions and military operations, even in those areas, such as Southeast Asia or the Near East, where a British commander was nominally in charge. In the same way, the United States had indirect control over much of Britain's post-war planning. In spite of the fact that the Anglo-Americans had agreed in ambiguous terms with Molotov's insistence on the need for a direct attack on Hitler in Europe in 1942, it was perfectly clear that no such assault could be made that early in the war, so the attack on North Africa was offered as a substitute. In the course of the North African fighting, it became clear that the cross-channel attack could not be mounted before the spring of 1944. Accordingly, when the Germans in North Africa surrendered in May 1943, it was necessary to open a new front against Hitler quickly, since it would have been very dangerous to leave Hitler free to throw most of his forces against Russia for a full year. Plans for attacks on Sardinia or Sicily had been prepared, and on January 23, 1943, orders were issued to invade the latter island during the favorable July moon. This was not regarded by the Russians as a major effort, and their resentment rose to the boiling point. As Secretary of State Hull put it in his memoirs, the atmosphere in Anglo-Russian relations became reminiscent of what it had been exactly 4 years earlier, just before the Nazi-Soviet Treaty of August 1939. It was at this time, apparently, that two fateful and mutually incompatible decisions were made on the highest levels of authority in Washington and Moscow. The decision made in Washington is one we have already mentioned, the decision to try to win Soviet cooperation in the post-war world by doing everything possible to win her trust and cooperation in the wartime period. This decision was probably based on the belief that it was not possible to control Russia's post-war behavior by any policy of force against her during the war itself, since such an effort would benefit Hitler without winning any enforceable agreements from Stalin. At this time, it would appear, Stalin made his decision to seek Russian security in the post-war world, not through any scheme for friendly cooperation in some idealistic international organization, as Roosevelt hoped, but by setting up, on the Soviet Union's western frontiers, a buffer area of satellite states under governments friendly to Moscow. Such governments, probably in communist control, would replace the cordon sanitaire, which the Western powers had created to isolate Russia following the First World War, with what might be called a cordon insanitaire, which could serve to isolate the Soviet Union from the outside world following World War II. Washington was informed of this possibility by the American ambassador in Moscow on April 28, 1943, but paid little attention to the warning, probably because of the near impossibility of finding any alternative policy toward the Soviet Union. In spite of Soviet scorn, the military operations in Africa and the Mediterranean were major efforts for the inexperienced forces of unmilitarized nations. Although they obviously could not compare to the Nazi-Soviet deathlock involving hundreds of divisions on the plains and in the forests of Eastern Europe, the victory in North Africa was completed in May 1943. 2 months later came the invasion of Sicily. The attack on this strategic island was the greatest landing assault of the war, 8 divisions coming ashore simultaneously, side by side. The island is almost a right-angled triangle, with its right angle in the extreme northeast, separated from the Italian mainland by the Strait of Messina, only 3 miles wide. The landings were made on the opposite side of the island, on the hypotenuse of the triangle, where the coast faces southwestward, toward Tunisia. The British 8th Army, under General Montgomery, with 250,000 men in 818 ships and escort vessels, landed on the southeastern point of the Sicilian Triangle, while the American 7th Army, General George Patton, with 228,000 men and 580 vessels, landed on the British left on either side of Gila. The defensive forces of 4 Italian divisions and 2 German panzer divisions were widely scattered on the island, and the Allied landings were skillfully executed against light resistance, July 10, 1943. Once ashore, however, the campaign was ineptly carried on because occupation of territory was given precedence over destruction of enemy forces. Patton drove northwestward to seize Palermo, July 22nd, and then followed the enemy forces eastward to Messina, along the northern coast. Montgomery, moving slowly northward parallel to the eastern coast, made a detour to the west of Mount Etna. No efforts were made to close the Straits of Messina. As a result, the Germans were able to send almost 2 divisions as reinforcements from Italy, and later, when the island had to be abandoned, they were equally free to evacuate it, carrying almost 40,000 troops with 9,650 vehicles and 17,000 tons of stores over the Straits of Messina to Italy in 7 days without loss of a man. At the same time, in a separate operation, 62,000 Italian troops also escaped to the mainland. By August 17th, Sicily had been conquered, but the evacuated enemy forces were reorganizing to defend Italy itself. The Italians had no taste for the defense of Italy. They had been dragged into the war by Mussolini's action, and against their own desires, in June 1940, and by 1943 they were heartily sick of the whole thing. This discontent was fully developed long before the attack on Sicily in June. In February, the Duce had dismissed Count Ciano, his son-in-law, and Count Dino Grandi from their posts as ministers of foreign affairs and of justice because of their defeatism and opposition. But these qualities continued to spread, even in the innermost circles of the government. The invasion of Sicily gave the final spurt to this development. On July 24th, the Fascist Grand Council passed a motion calling for the restoration of the constitutional functions of all agencies of the government and the restoration to the king of full command of the armed forces. This motion, carried 18-8, was essentially a vote of no confidence in Mussolini. The following morning, the king demanded the Duce's resignation, and, as he was leaving the palace, had him arrested. The fall of Mussolini on July 25, 1943, after being in power for over 20 years, did nothing to improve Italy's position. The king, who was opposed to the establishment of a parliamentary regime or a responsible government, put Marshal Pietro Badoglio, the conqueror of Ethiopia, in as head of the government, but would not allow him to establish a cabinet of non-fascist leaders. The fascist party was abolished, and the fascist militia was incorporated into the regular army, but it was impossible to get rid of fascist sympathizers from either the administrative system or from the armed services. On the whole, the fall of Mussolini was welcomed by the Italian people, not because of any political ideas, but simply because they believed that it would lead to the end of the war and the end of food rationing. It achieved neither of these, because the powers of contending forces were too evenly balanced in Italy to allow any decisive outcome to be reached. The history of Italy in 1943 is a history of lost opportunities, perhaps necessarily lost, but nevertheless a disappointment to everyone concerned. If events had turned out favorably, Italy might have got out of the war in the summer of that year, and the Germans might have been ejected from the peninsula shortly afterward. Instead, Italy was torn to pieces. Its people and the invading Allied troops suffered great hardships, and the country got out of the war so slowly that Germans were still fighting on Italian soil at the final surrender in 1945. The general misfortunes of Italy were the result of a number of forces working together. One was the military weakness of Italy in respect to Germany. This made it impossible for Italy to end the war, or even to surrender to the Allies, because any effort to do so would lead to an immediate German seizure of the whole country and of its leaders. The exploitation and devastation of the one and the massacre of the others. Italy was far too weak to hold the Germans back long enough to permit an Allied occupation of Italy. A second factor was the weakness of the Allies because of the diversions of their power to Britain in preparation for Overlord. This meant that the Allies lacked the strength to move quickly into Italy to protect it from complete German occupation, even if Italy could surrender secretly to the Allies and cooperate with their entrance. A third factor was the complete mistrust of the Italians, both by the Germans and by the Allies. This mistrust, for which the political conduct of the Italians, both foreign and domestic, over at least two generations, was responsible, provided the key to the whole situation. The only way in which the fighting in Italy could have been ended quickly would have been for Italy to surrender secretly to the Allies and cooperate with them in an immediate large-scale invasion of northern Italy. But the Allies were too distrustful of the Italians to cooperate with them in a project such as this, or even to accept a secret surrender. And finally, a fourth obstacle was the wooden and inflexible Allied insistence on unconditional surrender, which, meaningless as it might have been, nevertheless made it impossible for the Badoglio government either to cooperate with the Allies as co-belligerents against the Germans, as it wished to do, or to keep the surrender secret from the Germans long enough to forestall their violent reactions. Not only did unconditional surrender exclude both co-belligerency and secrecy, it also left the Italians helpless to resist the Germans. Above all, these four factors made it impossible to prevent a German seizure of Rome, which was, in some ways, the center of the whole problem. The Germans, who had 8 divisions in Italy, doubled this number as soon as they heard of the fall of Mussolini. They refused a request from the Badoglio government to allow any of the 53 Italian divisions in the Balkans and Russia to return home, thus holding them as hostages. When the Badoglio government made contact with the Allies through Madrid on August 16th and offered to join them in fighting Germany, all it could obtain was a demand for unconditional surrender. After days of discussion, an armistice accepting the Allied terms was signed on September 3rd, with the understanding that it would be kept secret until the Allies had troops ready to land in force on the mainland. 3 days later, the Italian government discovered that the Allied landing operation, already in progress, was only a small force and was headed for Salerno, south of Naples, where it would be no help to the Italians in resisting any German efforts to take over most of Italy. They insisted that the publication of the armistice and a tentative Allied paratrooper drop in Rome must be put off until sufficient Allied forces were within striking distance of Rome to protect the city from the German troops near it. Eisenhower refused and published the Italian surrender on September 8th, 1 day before the American 7th Army landed at Salerno. The Germans reacted to the news of the Italian betrayal and of the Allied invasion of southern Italy with characteristic speed. While the available forces in central Italy converged on the Salerno beachhead, an armored division fought its way into Rome. Italian troops were disarmed or intimidated everywhere, and the Badoglio government, with King Victor Emmanuel, had to flee to the British-controlled area around Brindisi. Much of the Italian fleet escaped to Allied control in the Mediterranean, but numerous vessels were sunk by the Germans or were scuttled to escape falling into their hands. In most of Italy, there was political paralysis and confusion. At some places, Italians fought one another, or simply murdered one another, while opinion ranged the whole gamut from complete indifference on one extreme to violent fanaticism on the other. In order to have some legal excuse for controlling Italy, the Germans sent parachutists to rescue Mussolini from his prison in a summer hotel in the mountains of the Gran Sasso, escaping with him by air to northern Italy, where he was presented with a German-picked government of neo-fascists. Under the name Italian Social Republic, September 13th through the 15th, 1943. Broken and weary, the ex-Duce of Fascism became a pliant tool of German ruthlessness and of the corrupt and criminal neo-fascists who surrounded him. In this group, the most influential were the family of Mussolini's mistress, Carla Petazzi, which Count Chiano called that circle of prostitutes and white slavers which for some years have plagued Italian political life. In Allied hands, the King and Badoglio were forced, on September 29, 1943, to sign another, much longer armistice. By its provisions, the Italian government were bound hand and foot and made completely subject to the will of the Allied governments as expressed through the Allied commander-in-chief. In conformity to this will, on October 13th, the King's government declared war against Germany. As the Allied forces slowly recovered Italian territory from the tenacious grasp of the Germans, the royal government remained subservient to its conquerors. Civilian affairs, immediately behind the advancing battle lines, were completely in military hands under an organization known as Allied Military Government of Occupied Territory, or AMGOT. Farther back, civilian affairs were under an Allied Control Commission. The creation of these organizations, on a purely Anglo-American basis, to rule the first Axis territory to be liberated, became a very important precedent for Soviet behavior when their armies began to occupy enemy territory in Eastern Europe. The Russians were able to argue that they could exclude the Anglo-Americans from active participation in military government in the East, since they had earlier been excluded from such participation in the West. While these political events were taking place, the military advance was moving like a snail. The Allied invasion of Italy, at American insistence, was given very limited resources for a very large task. This limitation of resources in Italy sought to prevent the British from using the Italian campaign as an excuse for delaying or postponing the cross-channel attack on Europe scheduled for the spring of 1944. It was only under such limitations of resources, explicitly stated that the Americans had accepted the British suggestion for any invasion of mainland Italy at all. In May 1943, at a plenary meeting in Washington, the combined chiefs of staff had set May 1944 as target date for a cross-channel invasion of Europe with 29 divisions, had ordered a full-scale aerial offensive of Germany with 2,700 heavy and 800 medium bombers, had given the American Joint Chiefs of Staff complete control over the Pacific War against Japan, and had asked General Eisenhower to draw up plans for an invasion of Italy using no forces beyond what he had on hand. This last limitation was repeated on July 26th, when the general was ordered to carry out his plans. The invasion of Italy was a two-pronged effort. On September 3rd, two British divisions under General Montgomery crossed the Straits of Messina and began to move northward against little opposition. 6 days later, a British airborne division from Bezerte was landed at Taranto and began to move up the Adriatic coast. On the same day, September 9th, the 5th Army of two American and two British divisions under Lieutenant General Mark W. Clark landed at Salerno. The landing site was in the next bay south of the famous Bay of Naples, and separated from it by the rugged Sorrento Peninsula. There was no preliminary bombardment by naval guns in order to retain tactical surprise, and the American units came over the heavily mined and barbed-wired beaches right into the face of the German 16th Panzer Division. Within 3 days, six German divisions, four of them motorized, were around the Salerno beachhead with 600 tanks. In fierce fighting, the area was slowly expanded, although at one point the German counterattacks almost broke through to the beach. Naval gunfire against the German tanks was the decisive factor in a seesaw struggle. On September 13th, the American 82nd Airborne Division was dropped behind the beachhead. About the same time, Rommel, in command in northern Italy, refused to release reinforcements to Kesselring in the south. On September 16th, the latter commander authorized a withdrawal from the area in order to get beyond the range of naval gunfire. On the same day, Montgomery's English army made contact with Clark's 5th Army, and an Allied line was stretched across Italy to the Adriatic. This line moved slowly northward, capturing Naples on the first day of October 1943. The city was a shambles, filled with wreckage and heavily booby-trapped. The water supply had been deliberately polluted, and all food stores and government records had been destroyed. The harbor area, completely in flames, was filled with sunken ships, locomotives, and other large objects to make it unusable. This was the kind of situation where American energy, humanitarianism, and ingenuity excelled. Sanitation and order were restored at once. Food was provided for the hungry Italians, and the harbor was cleaned up so successfully that it was holding tonnage beyond its pre-war rated capacity within 3 months. By October 7th, the Allied advance had been stopped on the Volturno River line, 20 miles north of Naples. 2 months later, when General Eisenhower was transferred to take over the supreme command for the approaching invasion of Western Europe, the Allied lines had moved northward no farther than the German Gustav line. This line, 80 miles south of Rome, and following, roughly, the Rapido River in the west and the lower Garigliano in the east, took every advantage of the rugged terrain and allowed the enemy to inflict heavy casualties on the attackers, especially by artillery fire from the greatly feared German 88mm guns. To outflank this position, an amphibious landing was ordered beyond the German rear at Anzio, just north of the Pontine Marshes, 30 miles south of Rome. Originally, the landing was to have been made in one operation, leaving the Allied forces on a beach with supplies for 8 days and no provision for any reinforcements or replenishment from the sea. This was based on the expectation that the main Allied forces would come up from the south in time to relieve the new beachhead. When it became clear that the Allied forces could not advance up the peninsula, the plan was cancelled on December 22nd. 3 days later, at a hurriedly summoned conference at Tunis, Churchill was able to have the plan reinstated, offering a British division to go with the single American division originally planned. On January 20, 1944, General Clark tried to cross the flooded Rapido River at the foot of the great hill on which stood the ancient Benedictine monastery of Monte Cassino. His aim was to advance northward toward Anzio. After 2 days of bloody fighting, the crossing had to be abandoned. That same day, January 22nd, two Allied divisions landed at Anzio, hoping to cut the German communications going southward toward Monte Cassino. The landing was easy, but within a week, Marshal Kesselring was able to shift sufficient forces from the subsiding Rapido front to seal off the Anzio beachhead. Although the Allies committed 4 more divisions to the Anzio operation, giving 6 in all, they could not break out of the German vise. The result was a stalemate in which the Germans could hold both the Rapido line and the Anzio line by shifting forces rapidly from one to the other as seemed necessary. As is usual in a stalemate, there was much of criticism of these operations, especially from the Allied side. It was suggested that the German success in holding the Rapido was due to the accuracy of their artillery fire, and that this was being spotted from the ancient monastery, founded by Saint Benedict in AD 529, on the top of Monte Cassino. It was further suggested that General Clark should have obliterated the monastery with aerial bombardment, but had failed to do so because he was a Catholic. After February 15, 1944, General Clark did destroy the site completely by Air Force bombs, without helping the situation a bit. We now know that the Germans had not been using the monastery, but once it was destroyed by us, they dug into the rubble to make a stronger defense. The stalemate on the Gustav Line was broken in the latter half of May 1944. By that time, French, Polish, and Italian units were fighting on the Allied side, giving 27 Allied divisions against 20 German. On May 16th, a French corps crossed the Garigliano River, and 3 days later, after terrible casualties, a Polish division captured Monte Cassino. Kesselring sullenly withdrew northward, followed by the Allied forces. The latter were greeted with hysterical enthusiasm by the liberated Italians. On May 25th, contact was made with the Anzio forces, and on June 4th, 1944, the American 88th Division, an all-selective service unit, entered Rome.